queer life in Montreal was wild.
Montreal in the 90s was a great time, but it had a dark side.
It was not a safe city for gay people back then.
But what else was behind a series of deaths in the city?
Somebody's killing gay men. We want to know why.
I'm Francis Plourde, and this is The Village, The Montreal Murders. Get early access to episodes at cbc.ca/listen or by subscribing to the CBC True Crime Premium channel on Apple Podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
And big story this week, Rosie. Canada's former military ombudsman says he had evidence of alleged sexual misconduct involving the country's former top general that the Minister of Defense refused to look at. What will it take for the military to change?
Also this week, we are expecting almost a million COVID-19 vaccine doses to arrive in Canada. That's all in 1 week. A lot of them are the newly approved AstraZeneca vaccine. So as more jurisdictions are starting to be able to vaccinate more and more people, our government's prioritizing those who need it most.
So much to get into, so let's do it.
Do it.
So we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, and it's important to note that timeline because we are talking just after Gary Wahlborn, who's a retired military ombudsman. He just finished testifying in front of the Standing Committee on National Defense. Mm-hmm. And what he had to say was a big deal, and I'm going to come back to it in a moment, but I think we actually got to take a minute to do a bit of setup here.
Take a minute, yes.
Let's do it. Okay, so last week, Canada's top military commander, that's Admiral Art MacDonald, he voluntarily stepped aside after it was discovered that he was under investigation by the military's National Investigation Service for possible sexual misconduct. His predecessor, General Jonathan Vance, is also under investigation for inappropriate behavior, including a long-running relationship with his subordinate, Major Kelly Brennan, who has spoken about this publicly. And there's a separate allegation being investigated that Vance sent a racy email to a junior female non-commissioned officer. So that's two of this country's top military leaders facing accusations of some form of sexual misconduct, which had a lot of people wondering, if you're the Minister of Defense, what did you know and when did you know it? Which brings us back to Gary Wahlborn. That's the guy who is testifying today. His testimony focused on Jonathan Vance. And what he said does not look good for the Minister of Defense. Wahlborn said that he had irrefutable, concrete evidence of an allegation against General Vance. He said he tried to show that evidence to the Minister of Defense and that Minister of Defense Sajjan refused to look at it. This happened on March 1st, 2018, so 3 years ago, and is all taking place in this larger context, which is that General Vance and his successor were supposed to be leading this widespread effort to root out sexual misconduct in the military. It's an operation called Operation Honor. So that's how we got here today.
Yeah, a couple of other points, perhaps, from the testimony of Gary Wahlborn. The complaint that he brought to Minister Sajjan was informal and anonymous. The complainant, he said, didn't want to file a formal complaint because she was worried about what the consequences would be for her. And mm-hmm. So her name was left out of it. Wahlborn also says that he actually had, it was paper evidence. He wouldn't go into it, but we've reported that it is, as you said, some sort of series of emails. He says that he had that email in his pocket. And when he went to reach for the email to get it to show the minister pushed away from his desk and wouldn't look at it. And that of course, is just the account of Mr. Wahlborn. He then says that Sajjan took this informal complaint and brought it to the Privy Council office, which is sort of like the Prime Minister's department, right? They're the ones that sort of run the Prime Minister's office. The Privy Council office then called Wahlborn in and asked for the information that he couldn't give them because this was not a formal complaint and the person wanted to remain confidential. And that's where things sort of fell apart, if you will. And the relationship between Wahlborn and Sajjan was soured and everything sort of went off the rails. And Wahlborn left his post before his time was up. So effectively, we don't believe that the process went any further beyond that then, because certainly nothing else happened to the general and he stayed in his job. But what I think is important to note about this is that Walburn felt like he had nowhere to go with this, right? Like his direct report was to the minister. He couldn't go to the chief of the defense staff, Jonathan Vance, and say, hi, we have this little issue. He felt he had nothing to do. So he went to Sargent in hopes that something would happen. He also says that he went to Sargent because he had the impression from the complainant that if she was given some assurances from the minister that she would be okay in her job, that then maybe a formal complaint could go forward. So it shows you, I think, that piece of it at least, that this is all inside the same circle, right? And it's really hard when you want to make a complaint in the military to get outside that circle and make sure that someone can protect you, given everyone's in that same place together. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That visual that Walburn provided of the Minister of Defense physically refusing to look at evidence is quite striking, because again, like, we are existing in this world where there are these reports of rampant sexual misconduct in the military in 2013. There was an independent report that was incredibly scathing from the former Supreme Court Justice Marie Duchamp. Her analysis said that the military had this highly masculine sexualized culture where leaders turn a blind eye to misconduct. And then so you have this moment where the Minister of Defense is, according to testimony, being presented with this evidence and is refusing to look at it so as to say, like, I'm not the person to deal with this. And well, if you're not the person to deal with this, if this account is true, then who is? Like, where does this buck actually stop? And that's why we're talking about this issue now, because the idea that the Minister of Defense knew that there was a problem with General Jonathan Vance and did not pursue it, or specifically pushed it off his desk, and this is the top commander of the Canadian military, is a highly concerning visual for any government, but it's particularly a concerning visual for this government, a government that has made a lot of inequality and a lot of, like, gender issues part of their their promise, part of their image. And so this feels like a big branding issue for the Liberals, but also it just speaks to this ongoing, continuous problem with the military. I honestly cannot recall the number of times that the problem of sexual assault in the military has come up again and again and again just in the last decade or so, because it feels like every 6 months we have a new entry into the story and nothing really changes.
Just for the record, we will let you know what the Minister of Defense said after this testimony today in a statement. He says that eliminating sexual misconduct and creating a safe work environment has been one of his top priorities as minister. He goes on to say in his statement that he disagrees with part of the testimony, that he was shocked. He was as shocked as everyone else at the allegations that were made public last month. That any allegations that were brought forward were very quickly put forward to the proper authorities while respecting the need to protect the privacy of any individuals involved. Any suggestion that I have done otherwise, he says, is wrong. So that's his statement for the record. I would point out that in the case of the most recent Chief of the Defense Staff, Art MacDonald, a tip came into a number of newsrooms that there was an allegation being made and looked at. It was only after that that question went into the minister's office that the minister then was in touch with the chief of the defense staff, and that the chief of the defense staff stepped aside, knowing that he was being investigated. So it may be true that the minister said that he put forward the information to the proper authorities. I think, given the way things unfolded with Art MacDonald, it is not true that was the only thing that the minister could have done. There were lots of different avenues that he could have taken. The very least of which, frankly, might have been to say to General Vance, I am hearing things, and in light of that, I don't think you should be in charge of Operation Honor anymore. At the very least, it would have perhaps helped that mission to try and remove some of that sexual misconduct and misogyny that is has been found to be prevalent inside the military. Those things didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So I guess there's two things, right? Is this a moment for the military finally to try and get a handle on these issues? And then I think the second thing is how much of this does the minister wear in terms of accountability?
You know, it's striking to me that every time that we start this discussion, we sort of start it from the same place, which is asking the question, is the military capable of changing itself? And that's because every once in a while, we get hints that it is. You know, we get hints that people at the top are willing to engage and roll out this massive initiative called, you know, Operation Honor and take this stuff seriously. And it appears as though it's going well, or at least visually, like all the visuals are there that it's going well. But I actually think we need to get to a deeper question, which is, what is behind the federal government's hesitation to get involved in overhauling the military culture? Because it seems like, and this is not a liberal government problem, this has been an ongoing problem for decades. Liberal governments, conservative governments have dealt with the same issues, and for the most part, they've stepped off. They've decided to let the military kind of, for the most part, regulate itself. And if this were any other extension of our public service, we would be horrified. Like, if this was any other department that was specific, we would say, like, well, no, of course, some higher authority needs to intervene. But the military does not get that kind of oversight, or at least it doesn't appear to get that oversight. And you get reports from a retired ombudsman, the Minister of Defense, physically pushing away from wading into the issue in a deeper way. And, like, I think it's important to remind our audiences, like, they're not living in Groundhog Day. Like, this is a new instance of the same issue that keeps coming up. And every time that it comes up, like, we ask the same questions. And that must be frustrating. But the heavier question that we have to get to is, like, okay, if the military can't change itself, then what can change it? And who has the authority to change it? Because surely somebody does.
Yeah, I think one of the differences between the military and other departments, other than, you know, the role of the military, which is sort of central to any nation's sovereignty, is also that the military has its own police force, has its own court system, has a judge advocate general, where these internal investigations and allegations can be dealt with for all sorts of things, not just sexual misconduct. So that sort of right from the get-go sets it apart and makes it more difficult for a government to get a handle on. That's what I would suggest. But the part that could be done, and again, that even Gary Wahlberg talked about today, is some sort of independent body or some sort of independent oversight. Mm-hmm. If you are constantly having complaints that are going to the same place, a complaint about an organization going to the organization, there's just no way to get a grip on things. And I think that is sort of what they have been encumbered by for many decades. Remember, Operation Honor started in 2015. It's 2021. Right. And we have lost two generals. I mean, Vance was retiring, but he's now under investigation. McDonald was in the job for a month and is now under investigation. Like, maybe it's fair to say at this point that this is not working. And I think that's where you could, as a government, make a decision. Maybe a difficult decision. Maybe it's a bold choice. Maybe it wouldn't be widely accepted. But at some point, you would have to say, well, this actually isn't working as well as we want it to anymore, I would think.
And to that end, Wahlberg was asked about this. He was asked about what it takes to change the mindset inside the military in terms of people getting to fully understand this issue, because he's just not seeing the support that he needs. And this is what he said to the committee.
But I believe in order to fully understand, you almost need to be a victim. Someone comes to a place of authority looking for help, guidance, assistance, and they're told, sorry, we don't have any for you. That's kind of heartbreaking. They have to go back to that individual and say, you know, I didn't get the reception that I was looking for. That's kind of hard information and detail to take back to a complaint, to a victim in this type of a circumstance.
This is from someone who, for years, their main job was to investigate exactly these kinds of allegations. And what he's telling us is that in order for the understanding internally to change, you're looking at people almost needing to be a victim. Those were his words. In order to fully understand the gravity, the systemic nature of this culture, and also just the lack of options that victims have in the military, which is a theme that keeps coming up again and again and again.
Amina is an activist during the Arab Spring. Her blog, Gay Girl in Damascus, attracts readers from around the world. When she's mysteriously abducted, her followers mobilize, desperate to save her. What they find shocks them. I'm Samira Moyeddin, the host of Gay Girl Gone, a new 6-part series from CBC. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I would say, largely, that this following statement would be true for the entire country, that everyone is wanting to know where they are in the list of who gets the vaccine next. Would that be a fair generalization for every human in the country?
Can you imagine if I was like, no, I'm not curious. You let me know whenever you feel like. No, I'm like, I'm reading everything I can just to get an idea of where I am in this queue. What is this queue? Where are we at in this queue? Yes, 100%.
And like if there's some kind of calculator where you can like put in your age and like your weight and your eye color, does that change anything? I'll do all of those. But it doesn't actually we actually obviously can't do anything about it. It is a set of recommendations made by the National Advisory Committee on Immunization, which the cool kids in Ottawa called NACI. They make a set of recommendations to provinces, and then provinces make decisions based on that. And the priorities that they've laid out there are pretty much what you would expect. Right now, the country is in stage one. So it's, you know, people in long-term care homes where the vast majority of deaths have been, adults over 80, healthcare workers, Indigenous communities. And then they move into stage two, other congregate living settings. Other adults under 80, 70, 60, 65, racialized or marginalized communities. Then we get to stage three, and it's people with underlying medical conditions, other health care workers who might not be frontline. And then finally, after we've made our way through all of those groups, it's like everybody else. So you and I.
Yes.
Everybody else. and all of that makes a lot of sense. You want to, when you're vaccinating people, hit all your most vulnerable people right away to try and protect them and save their lives and then work towards the people who are less vulnerable. But there's been such an interesting conversation over the past couple of weeks around who else should be on this phase one priority list. There are, for instance, people representing the disabled community who say, well, just because this person is 20 but does have some underlying conditions, why do they have to wait so long? There have been police officers in Toronto who are now going to be vaccinated, even though they don't really have direct involvement necessarily with COVID cases, but might come in contact with people. So it's created, I don't know, maybe an ethical conversation about how we make these decisions, because you have a set of guidelines from NACI and then provinces sort of go out and do their own thing.
I mean, the interesting thing to me here is that we weren't prepared for this conversation, even though we've had all this time to prepare for it. It's like we're asking questions now that we were asking in, I don't know, like October or November in terms of, well, who will get the vaccine first? And they just appear to be such, you know, unevolved, like kind of really early stage conversations about, you know, if somebody has an underlying condition and they're in their 20s, should they be going early or later? It's like, I'm surprised that this wasn't figured out 5 months ago or so. I'm surprised that we're still having these conversations. The other thing that is apparent to me here is that we have squarely entered the realm where politics is involved, right? Like the story about Toronto police officers getting vaccinated is really interesting for a lot of different reasons. But one of the biggest reasons is, well, how many police officers have gotten COVID in the line of duty? Do we know? Is it zero? Is it 100? We have no idea how exposed they are. And so now suddenly we have to weigh the reality on the ground with also like the political considerations of, well, why should the police officers go first? Shouldn't teachers be, you know, being given these vaccines first? And all of these questions might be phrased in a scientific way, but mm-hmm. like they really are political questions. They're sure. not in the hands of scientists. They become political landmines for everybody.
Yeah. And it does, again, then speak to some of the things we've seen through the pandemic. Those people who we consider essential workers, and certainly police officers fall into that category, but the other essential workers that are sort of less visible, the people in the grocery stores, in the factories, in the meatpacking plants where there have been huge outbreaks, some of the biggest outbreaks in this country, why are they not ahead of the police officers, given that they are working in these tight conditions and we've seen outbreaks happen? Where is the conclusion there? Like, how are they drawing that conclusion? We're also seeing a lot of lobbying, to be frank, right? For some groups to get vaccinated before others. Police would fall into that. There is some lobbying going on by grocery store workers. Teachers are also lobbying. And then it becomes kind of uncomfortable, right? Like, because you're having to make decisions because you've got someone knocking on your door a lot. And you might have these sort of good guidelines given by NACI. But then as a politician and a health minister across the country, you have to make some other decisions. And remember, those decisions are a lot easier to make when the vaccine is scarce. But obviously, then you're giving it to long-term care homes. Like, obviously, you're helping the older Canadians. But when we get to a space now where this week we're receiving close to 1 million doses, then you start to get into a more difficult conversation. Quebec, for instance, has decided, listen, we feel like we are in big trouble in Montreal. We are in big trouble in Montreal and on the South Shore in Laval. We are going to do more vaccines in those areas because we think that we're going to lose people if we don't. So then that becomes an interesting conversation about sort of the urban setting of vaccinating people. There's just more people that live there. So those people get priority over people who choose to live in more rural settings. I don't know. That to me also seems kind of fraught.
Yeah. I mean, the notion that, you know, Brighton, Ontario ends up getting the vaccine or fully vaccinated before, say, a place like Toronto that has much more density and a lot more people, and therefore a much higher chance of if one person is infected and they end up infecting a lot more people. Like, that doesn't really compute to me, but like, these are all parts of the considerations that are now not just health recommendations, but also political considerations. And we should also say that BC has made an interesting decision. They decided that they want to extend the intervals between vaccine doses. The Moderna and Pfizer vaccine doses, you're supposed to get about 3 to 4 weeks apart. BC is going to 4 months between the first dose and the second dose. And they're not the only jurisdiction to do this. Like, the United Kingdom has pushed back their second dose. New Zealand has done the same. Dr. Bonnie Henry said that the data that they're getting from the BC Center for Disease Control actually shows pretty good protection from the Pfizer and the Moderna doses, because the first dose protects about 90%. That's pretty incredible. Then you get the second dose and it pushes that additional bit. Now a bunch of other provinces are following suit, and NACI has come out with a recommendation saying that, you know what, in the context of having limited vaccine supply, yes, we can extend the interval between the first and second dose to 4 months. And this has the potential to change a lot when it comes to the vaccine rollout in this country.
For sure, because that means if you can get more people in that first dose and get them some like significant coverage and protection from the virus, that means that we could be moving along at a really fast clip pretty soon.
The other interesting news story this week is that Joe Biden came out and said that because of Merck and Johnson & Johnson's partnership, the U.S. is going to have enough vaccine for every adult in the United States by the end of May, which is pretty staggering. Their original deadline was the end of July, but now it's the end of May. Could that mean the U.S. giving us more vaccine supply?
It's a possibility for sure. When the prime minister was asked about it on Wednesday, on the day we record this, he said just that. It's a possibility that it could happen, which would be great because we would get more sooner. The thing that he leaned on to back that up is that the president and the secretary of state have both talked about how having continental coverage for vaccines, so Canada, the U.S. and Mexico, is sort of what they're after as an endgame. I will say this, the one thing I find sort of reassuring, I think, and the thing I think other people should find reassuring is that we are in, you know, uncharted territory as we have been through this whole bloody thing. And we are in a space where we have three approved vaccines, which is great. And it does seem as though the science and policy are trying to keep up with one another. You know, like we learn more about the vaccine, we learn more about the virus, and we try and make decisions. Governments try and make policy decisions that keep up with the science. And I think that that's a good thing. I'm not saying it's devoid of politics, as you've well pointed out, but I think it's probably a good thing that this be a live conversation, that we don't just say, well, this is it, and then not be willing to be more flexible and see other categories of people, that this keep moving in the right direction as we understand more and more. You know what that is? That's the sound of glass vials, AstraZeneca or something else arriving this week, all clinking together. I think actually they're not supposed to do that. Like,
yeah, I was like, I hope they don't clink too hard. I don't want them to break. I'm too
worried
about
that's
this.
When they become bad, so we probably shouldn't say that. But anyway. Listen, last week we asked about a really serious topic that a lot of people were interested in. We talked about drug policy in Canada, and we asked you, should the federal government move more aggressively toward decriminalizing possession of small amounts of illicit drugs?
We heard from a lot of people on this one. One listener out of Vancouver wrote, "It is long overdue for the possession of drugs for personal use to be decriminalized. Addiction and drug use is not a criminal issue. It is a public health concern. We need a safe supply now. There are too many deaths in my city and my province." Another person said they want to see the kind of decision based on evidence and best practice in other countries like Portugal. Portugal, of course, decriminalized the possession and use of small amounts of illicit drugs way back in 2001. And someone else chimed in on that point about the future generations we talked about last week. It's the idea that maybe drug decriminalization is the kind of thing my daughter would look back on and say, I can't believe your generation didn't do more to help on this. And this listener said, with two kids of my own, I often think about the stuff that's deep in my belief system that will be coded differently in theirs and what my responsibility is to make sure they're a little wiser and kinder way down deep.
That person sounds pretty wise already.
Yeah.
Okay, so this week we want to know, do you think that vaccines are going to the people who need them most where you live? Because it's a little different across the country. So are they going to the people who need them most where you are? Tweet us. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Please throw in the hashtag. The hashtag is Party Lines, and let us know what you think.
And that is it for Party Lines this week. From CBC News and CBC Podcasts, I'm Rosemary Barton, Chief Political Correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud. I'm the Chief Cheerleader for all vaccines. It does not matter what kind of vaccine it is. I am pro it. And also culture writer for BuzzFeed News.
See you back here next week.
You bet.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.